Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Election Day is less than 2 weeks away, and we have in-depth looks at two of the more competitive General Assembly races in the 12th and 36th House districts. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also welcome back our political analysts, Republican Tom Kovach and Democrat Darrell Scott, to offer their perspectives on the statewide races voters will consider on the November 6th ballot. And in our latest arts playlist, hear from the Historic Odessa Foundation about an exhibition it's currently showing. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Election Day is November 6th, less than 2 weeks away now, and there are a bevy of competitive General Assembly races during this midterm cycle. We're taking a look at some of the key ones this week on The Green, starting in the 12th House District. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller tells us that's where Krista Griffith is challenging House Minority Whip Deborah Hudson for her seat.
Hudson, a Republican from Fairthorne, has represented the 12th House District since 1994. She was first elected civil court clerk in Newcastle County in 1986. Before that, she was a teacher at Claymont Middle School and an educator at Winter Tour Museum. Hudson says her focus is solely on her work as a state representative. She says that allows her to focus on local issues, as well as important statewide initiatives and creation of new public policy.
Because I am a full-time legislator, I get assigned to a lot of extra committees or task forces, and it gives me a chance to make the deep dive into something that's more of a statewide issue than something that's localized.
Democrat Krista Griffith is a Fairfax resident and mother of two. She defeated public school special education teacher and former attorney Rachel Blumenfeld in the September 6th Democratic primary with nearly 64% of the vote. She is a former deputy attorney general in the State Department of Justice, prosecuting crimes against seniors and cases of domestic violence. Griffith says she left her job in 2015 when her younger son Nate, who was born with Down syndrome, received a cancer diagnosis. She says they were lucky that his treatments worked. She says health care would be a big priority for her if elected. She says that while health insurance covered a lot of her son's care, she met other parents who didn't have the same coverage or were uninsured.
So it was really troubling to see families, you know, dealing with the worst days of their lives, you know, dealing with such a medical catastrophe, but also, you know, the financial issues that accompany that. So that affected me deeply.
Hudson says if reelected, her top priorities would include passing the Equal Rights Amendment and putting more funding into classrooms. She'd also like more money to fight the opioid crisis.
We had some successful bills that went through this year, but none that would actually create a funding stream to help with people that are trying to recover.
Griffith says her priorities would also include education and preparing youth who don't go to college for careers. But she also sees protecting the environment as important, pointing out the 12th District includes a piece of the state's national park.
We have Brandywine Creek State Park, we have Red Clay, and we have Superfund site in Hokeson. So water and the quality of water is definitely a concern.
The aquifer under Central Hokeson officially became a federal Superfund site earlier this year after qualifying because of groundwater contamination. Griffith believes she can better represent the district and address its issues better than Hudson. She argues Hudson has become more conservative and out of touch over time, while her constituents remain moderate. Griffith promises to be more responsive to their needs.
I will show up at civic association meetings, which my opponent is not doing. I will be present down in Dover on key votes, which my opponent doesn't always do. And I will be, you know, very in touch with the community.
Griffith also criticizes Hudson's vote against same-sex marriage in 2013. But Hudson says she holds independent views and doesn't shy away from controversial topics, citing her support for an assault weapons ban if it comes up again next year. The controversial legislation, sponsored by State Senator Brian Townsend, never made it to the House because it didn't get out of committee in the state Senate. despite an attempt to suspend the rules and bring it directly to the floor for a vote. She also touts key legislative accomplishments through her years in office, like the Clean Indoor Air Act enacted in 2002, the Child Victims Act of 2007, and the Delaware Cancer Treatment Access Act of 2012. She says she might have missed more votes last year than she's ever missed, but in life, some people miss work.
I apologize for that, but usually if I'm going to miss a day of work, I let the sponsors know of the bills that might be a close vote, just to be sure if they need my vote, they could have it another day, run the bill another day, because I would never want to hold up legislation.
Griffith says she believes her background and the experience with her family's medical challenges gives her the perspective to tackle policy issues on behalf of her constituents. Hudson says she wants to be reelected to pursue legislation she's been working on, like creating a separate committee to decide grant and aid funding. She also wants to strengthen the integrity of the political process by having candidates disclose unpaid state or federal taxes or child support before running for office. Registration in the 12th District is evenly split. Republicans hold a mere 147-person advantage over Democrats, with about 5,300 people unaffiliated or registered to other parties. Sarah Mueller, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And stay with us. We take a look at another race, the 36th House District, next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our look at key legislative races in next month's general election, turning our focus to the 36th House District in the Milford area. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele delves into that race.
With Republican State Representative Harvey Kenton retiring after 8 years to pursue other interests, the 36th Representative District is up for grabs, and the vacancy has drawn two very different contenders for that seat. The Democrat is Don Allen Jr., a carpenter by trade.
My dad was a carpenter, too, and when I was 12, and actually my brother started younger, my brother started when he was 10, which was the same year. I'm 2 years older than him. We started working summers and weekends with him, kind of helping out the family business. I tried to escape, but very quickly got drawn back in. So I went to Del Tech, actually, when I was 18 and for drafting, and then learned I didn't like sitting in front of a computer all day long. So I came back to work for him full-time in 2003. I've been there ever since, and my normal life, I am out installing kitchen cabinets or doing interior trim work every day, pretty much.
The Republican candidate is Milford Mayor Brian Shoup.
You know, I was a mayor for 2 terms in Milford, also a small business owner here for 2 small businesses for over 8 years. And I think we need a local voice in Dover. Harvey Kenton was a great local voice for us, representing us the last eight years. And I really feel like we need someone in Dover to carry on that tradition of a local voice that listens. People. As my record and mayor shows, we really did go out to the community and had community-driven responses to our issues. As we tackle challenges like strengthening our economy, rebuilding our roads, and ensuring clean water, I feel like someone with experience and someone with their ear to the ground will serve on the 36th District the best way that they can.
Both candidates agree that strong voices representing local interest are needed in state government. Allen says for far too long, government has been about the wealthy and corporations. And right now, there is no one like him representing constituents in Dover.
I mean, if you look across the country, 4% of our state legislative candidates, not the people that win, just the people that run, are from a working class background. I mean, we talk about equal representation across race, across sexual orientation, and we absolutely should have that as well. But we also should have it from background. Not everybody who represents us should be a business owner, an attorney, an accountant, and that tends to be what they are.
Shoup says he would also put local interest first if the people send him to Dover.
Strengthen our economy, rebuilding our roads, and ensuring clean water, but definitely ensuring strengthening our economy, making sure that we have high-quality jobs here. We already started that in Milford by planning the Bay Health Sussex campus alongside Bay Health and Memorial Pediatric and Senior Care, and we want to continue to see that. We want to make sure the middle-class families have quality jobs so they can bring home money to feed their kids and send them to college and do the things that they need on a daily basis.
Shoup also points to health care as an important issue in this race. He says he will continue to advocate for increased access to specialized health care.
And I think Sussex County is going to be a pivotal player in healthcare, and not only in Sussex County, but in the state of Delaware. I think that Milford will become the dominant player in healthcare. And
Allen agrees that healthcare is important, but suggests other issues need attention as well.
I think one of the places government should be doing is investing in infrastructure. We talk about attracting businesses. We talk about attracting people to our areas. We're not going to do that unless we have the roads to get to those places, unless we have broadband internet, which is a problem in Sussex County, unless we have good schools, newer, you know, not necessarily new schools, but improved schools, making sure we have all the resources we need for our teachers. All of that is infrastructure.
As the campaign enters the final stretch, both candidates are making their final pitch to voters in the 36th district for this open seat. Allen says he's run a truly grassroots campaign that connects with voters.
I'm very focused on people. I'm very proud that I have not raised one dime in this election from a single corporation, and I have outraised him. So I am very proud of that, and that's where I will say I focus. I will be focusing on working class, on middle class people, and that's why I'm doing this, and that's what I plan to do when I'm elected.
Shoup is asking voters to look at his history of reaching out to his constituents and delivering for them.
We actually built our platform around what our individuals at the doors were saying. So strengthen our economy, rebuilding our roads, and ensuring clean water. That's what we heard them say. And overall, though, I really do hear that they want a representative that has a track record of getting those things done, but also a track record of going out to people, not only on election year, but, you know, in the off years as well, listening to them and creating community-driven responses to their challenges.
Registration in the district is split fairly evenly, with Democrats holding a slim 53-person edge over Republicans and just over 4,000 people unaffiliated or registered with another party. Kelly Steele, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Kelly. And we'll look at two more legislative races next week on The Green. But up next, our political analysts Tom Kovac and Daryl Scott join us to offer their perspectives on the statewide races on the ballot November 6th. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We continue our 2018 election coverage by digging a bit deeper into the races with Delaware Public Media political analysts, Republican Tom Kovac and Democrat Daryl Scott. Kovac is a former North Wilmington State Representative and Newcastle County Council President, and he previously ran for U.S. House. Scott is a former state rep from the Dover area. This week, we get their take on the statewide races in the first state on November 6th. Well, let's start at the top of the ballots. UD Center for Political Communication poll last month found Senator Tom Carper holds a 61-24% lead over Rob Arlett in the U.S. Senate race. Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, a 52-28% advantage over Scott Walker in the U.S. House race. First, I have to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Tom. Is it surprising that Scott Walker is faring better than Rob Arlett, at least in this one poll?
Well, a lot of things are surprising about Scott Walker and his candidacy. The fact that he is the primary chosen candidate for the Republican Party, having run as a Democrat 2 years before, having a name recognition that's potentially based on a similar named, very famous Republican out in the Midwest, Governor Scott Walker. You know, who knows what got things going? You know, was it folks rejecting going for Rob Arlett, who got folks fired up against the other Republican candidate in the primary? Regardless, Scott Walker won the primary and is a candidate. Quite frankly, is he drawing on the support of Trump voters? Hey, this guy's from the outside. We don't care what he does in his real estate, holdings or is alleged to have done. And we like this person fighting against the system. You know, that could definitely have some appeal to an everyman voter and could explain some popularity. I mean, there's always been that kind of fascination and support of an everyman, especially somebody who's not perfect. I mean, that kind of goes against the conventional wisdom of squeaky clean political candidate, but with our current president, we can see that, that sometimes people don't necessarily go that direction.
Daryl?
Like my friend Tom, I was a little surprised, but again, when you look at, and some of the things you said, Tom, when you look at the political landscape and the willingness for people to support anybody who is sort of contrary and sort of outside of the political norm, you know, it's hard to be shocked these days. I was a little surprised. I was trying to look at the differences in the poll numbers between Arlette and Walker, and I think that among Democrats there was a slight difference in preference between the two, but although very slight. So it's again not really surprised, but again, sort of, it may be a sign of the times that the more extreme you are, the more likely you are to stand out.
Let me just talk a little bit more broadly about what we make of Walker. You know, he was disavowed by the GOP, the state party, after saying some things that were pretty racist and sexist on Facebook. Has also been flagged, as Tom alluded to, in media reports about issues involving properties he rents out to low-income people. Yet, on the other side of the coin, he showed up for our Delaware debates, produced with the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication, and all, by all accounts, performed as reasonably well as most candidates who show up for those type of debates. So I guess in the end, the question becomes, has he or has he not been a distraction for the GOP in trying to kind of coalesce its supporters behind its candidates writ large?
I guess the way I would respond is I'm not sure of the overall impact. I think that what's surprising when I've read some of the press and stories about the Republican Party and sort of the disavowing and the resignation of the party chair, you've got those in the party that are sort of dissatisfied with the new Castle County Republicans and sort of support of the moderate Republican, socially progressive and fiscally conservative, and the Sussex Republicans, who are, I would describe it as sort of Tea Party and anti-establishment, and see him as representing. So I think it has caused a fraction in the party. I think that not having a strong coordinated ticket at the top of the ticket on your statewides will have an impact down ticket to down ticket races.
Tom, is this just another symptom of a fracture that's already there in the state GOP party, or is this something different?
Well, you know, as we've talked about and I've seen discussed, you know, a lot in Delaware politics, you know, we've had this, you know, alleged fracture in the Republican Party, and there are absolutely differing views on, you know, how the Republican Party should go as a party. One of the problems with the Republican Party and one of the strengths of the Republican Party is its independence, and they foster that and encourage that. So, but you do have more of the Newcastle-leaning, willing to work across the aisle, and the, you know, Western Sussex-branded, you know, come hell or high water, we're fighting for our cause type of mentality. But it's no different than any organization, and including the Democratic Party, who's facing their own battles of folks willing to work across the aisles, willing to get things done. Looking no further than, you know, our Senator Coons in the recent confirmation hearings, you know, trying to broker deals with people.
Mm-hmm.
He was celebrated as a hero and lambasted as a traitor by his party. You know, I think both parties are facing this problem. The Republican one in Delaware gets talked about more often because Democrats are still winning for now.
That's a good point.
And it is. I think the point you make is that you've got progressives in the party, and so Evelyn Harris's Kerry Harris's campaign,
yep.
And the question is, will they come out to vote in November with since their candidate lost, right? And so the question is, how do you, you know, sort of bring them into the fold, and you know, Carper taking a position in support of $15 minimum wage and legalization of marijuana, I think, you know, is a demonstration of willingness and effort.
Olive branch.
An olive branch, yes. And so then the question becomes, you know, will will they come out again? So,
and that's honestly the same dynamic we saw last presidential election with the Bernie Sanders people and the Hillary Clinton people just kind of playing out at this level 2 years later.
Absolutely.
And when will that fracture, you know, occur? It's I want what I want, or I'm going to support somebody that's 80% of what I want. And that's, you know, again, while the party, the Democratic Party, is still winning in Delaware, it's going to, and it has been facing that, you know, that issue, and will face it more so in the future. You know, the GOP just got a jump start on it thanks to the 2010 election cycle.
Fair enough. But so just to move forward on this, then, you know, because, well, I guess what we're saying now is that maybe there's an issue in the Democratic Party as well, but it's not showing up at the ballot box just yet. It is in the GOP, and the question now is, for this particular election, is that top of the ticket, Rob Arlett, Scott Walker, a drag on those down ballot state treasurer, state auditor, where, you know, Ken Simpler, James Spitola would seem to have a shot at winning, perhaps if they had some coattails to run on?
Well, you know, I'll address this one, Tom, first. I think that, you know, you'd have no greater potential drag on a local election process than the President of the United States. And I'm not, actually, at this point, I'm not even Trump bashing in the slightest. I think that's a very common midterm election cycle that, you know, you come in and you have a huge, you know, counter new president election cycle, both on the national level when the majority, it's the biggest number of United States congressmen, United States representatives, lose their seats that are the same party as the president. That happens every, you know, off-election cycle of a new president. So, I think that's going to be a huge battle to overcome always in every state, including Delaware. The only thing that stopped that from happening in 2010, as we talked about, was another phenomenon which was interjected into our local election. So I think the Republicans are definitely and should be concerned about that issue. But the reason I brought up the 2010 election is because Delawareans looked at their local candidates when by 49 out of the 50 states lost state House seats for Democrats. They lost state House seats for Democrats after Barack Obama was elected two years later in the state elections. Delaware was the only state in the union to say, we don't give a crap about national elections. We're going to care more about our local elected folks. And you didn't have that swing back against the president. So I think where local Republicans have done a good job, Delaware, you know, has shown, and I have faith that Delaware will elect good local representatives and senators. It doesn't mean it's not tougher, and I think that not having a good, likable president definitely hurts, and I think that not having a super coordinated ticket definitely hurts. But Delaware voters have shown that they're educated enough about their local reps to still elect them despite national and top-of-the-ticket shenanigans.
Darrell, to that point, is the potential for a blue wave more likely to impact this election than the top-of-the-ticket, maybe weakness for GOP? Does one hold more weight in your mind?
I like to think maybe there's a perfect storm there, but in reality, I think that the blue wave. The turnout that we saw for Democrats in the primary would indicate sort of strong interest, and we believe there were new voters brought to the table from the Harris campaign. The conversation I've had with those running the coordinated campaign for the Democrats are seeing, you know, sort of strong interest, propensity or sort of affirming their willingness and plan to vote, seeing more of a tribalism or partisanship in sort of their thought process. So where they might have in the past been thinking of, I may switch, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, go down the ticket and make a choice of being more, it may be a referendum on Trump, it may be a combination of factors, but looking at and saying, I'm going to vote, you know, straight Democratic ticket. And I think that, again, when you have Republican candidates at the top that are aligning themselves with the president, given the unfair rules that exist, it doesn't help, right? And so maybe, on, as Tom said, on the local level, if they've raised money, they've run good campaigns, they've been out doing the door knocking and the retail politics that are necessary, they may be able to make that message. From a statewide perspective, without, you know, without strong turnout statewide, then you look at Simpler, you look at Spadola, and say that there could be some challenges there for those two candidates.
I want to let's talk specifically about those two individuals. You know, how much danger is Ken Simpler, incumbent state treasurer, who did kind of buck registration, all the other trends, and win state treasurer 4 years ago? How much danger is he in of losing, and does some of the noise around that particular race, including a Democratic complaint that he and Republican State Senator Greg Lavelle inappropriately coordinated with PACs, does that have an impact, or is that too inside baseball for most voters?
Well, I'll ask Tom if he thinks his Republican rock star will successfully surf the blue wave. So, Tom, you want to take that first?
Sure. Ken Simpler was elected pretty handily on a very, very simple message. Looking back 4 years, remember that message looked like it was going to be anti-incumbent, anti-incumbent, and incumbent, but Simpler wrote on a keep it simple, vote finance guy, finance job. And from what I've seen, he's campaigned the same way this time. Finance guy, finance job. You know, we've had the had the abacus before, you know, Ken Simpler came in and took over as treasurer, and, you know, the smartphone with the apps, you know, doing a better job investing states resources, you know, on the second picture. I haven't heard anything negative, you know, run by the Simpler campaign. It's been very simple. It's been very straightforward. Finance guy, finance job. By the way, look what I've done. And as a matter of fact, I saw, if I'm not mistaken, an editorial by Simpler is this overblown partisanship is crap. You know, yes, I'm a Republican, but I'm here to do the best job that I can. I'm not here to bash Democrats. I'm here to help be the best state treasurer I can be. So, you know, does that message still resonate in a hyper-partisan climate that we have? You know, again, from the president on down, clearly Simpler is not endorsing or picking up on the national Republican issues. He is trying to ignore them and focus on what he's done for Delaware and the importance of having him in that position. You know, that's what I see as a straight state treasurer race. Daryl?
So I was going to ask you if you thought that, you know, again, as Paul Ryan has done and others at the national level have failed to call out members of their own party for some of the, you know, the knuckleheaded things that they've said and done. And so Simpler, while you say, I agree, I mean, he ran on a very, you know, hire me, I'm a finance guy for a finance job, and trying to keep it very simple and straightforward. He also got some crossover vote. And so does he get sort of lumped in with, you know, this partisanship by failing to stand up to his party and call out some of those shenanigans to demonstrate that he is, you know, he's the guy that's going to work across party lines and stand up to the sort of the, you know, the fractions of the party that are far removed from sort of the norm?
Yeah, I mean, Daryl, that's an interesting question. I mean, we have that come up all the time. What duty is there for an elected official or somebody seeking office to call out the shenanigans of another elected official, you know, nationally, locally, globally, you know, if they do something that they shouldn't do? I mean, unfortunately, we often have elected officials letting the power go to their head and doing things that they shouldn't do nationally and regionally. You know, whose duty is it to call them out? You know, if you're a member of that party, do you have to separate yourself from them? Certainly the other party likes to tell you have to do that until they have a problem in their own party. You know, does every state representative have to come out and say, oh, what so-and-so candidate did as a Democrat was wrong? or do they run their own race?
And is there a risk also if Simpler does do that, he then alienates some of the more conservative people on the Republican side, and maybe they're not going to vote for the Democrat. They just sit out, and you lose the vote. Lose votes there.
It is a risk. I think that for those of us on my side of the aisle that see Simpler as the head of the Republican Party, right, sort of the future, you know, who if not him, to say that we need to broaden the sort of the umbrella and reach to make sure that we're appealing. And you know, with a registration disadvantage, you've got to get independent and Democratic votes mm-hmm. to win on a statewide basis. And so, but that was just a question. And thinking yeah. about it, I think that there are some differences in Simpler and Davis and sort of backgrounds. And I think she's got a compelling, you know, personal narrative that's being told. I see this as a barn burner of a race. I think it's going to be close, and one of the ones we'll watch and talk a lot about on election night.
Tom, you agree? It does seem like that as you said, Ken Simpler's message previously as a non-incumbent now kind of combined with his ability to say, well, here's what I've done, and you know, I did what I said I was going to do. Does still make him a formidable candidate in this race, particularly against someone who, even though you know the UD poll would indicate that you know Ken Simpler doesn't have a high level of name recognition, he certainly has a lot more name recognition than Conley Davis.
Right.
And to Daryl's point, you know, I think it will be a race to watch. I think it will be, you know, a bellwether. One election year goes to historically in Delaware, lean to the right, then to the left, then to the right, then to the left. Well, looking back in you know the 70s and 80s and 90s and Castle and Carper, these folks won by about the same percentage almost every time. You know, and will Delaware voters stick with that trend and vote for somebody that they believe can do the best job? Or is the hyper-partisanship reached the Delaware level? And I think that Simpler's race will bear that out. You know, if he still wins by a comfortable margin, then people say, okay, well, here in our small little state of Delaware, everybody knows everybody, you know, I'm going to vote for the candidate that I think could do the best job. Or is it because Davis comes in, you know, more of an unknown with little name recognition, if she prevails, it will more than likely, and no slight to her, but more than likely be the result of a blue wave. And is that what's going to control state elections from now on?
And I guess that takes us to the auditor's race. And I guess we're talking almost about the kind of same type of thing with James Spadola, someone who, you know, even in previous runs for state Senate has run kind of more as a Castle-like moderate Republican. You know, does he have an opportunity to win here? And I guess, you know, does the fact that the retiring state auditor, Republican Tom Wagner, decided to bring him in as a deputy in the final weeks of the campaign help, hurt, or is that a non-factor as well? Is it really just about, you know, can James Spadola, like Ken Simpler, simply kind of get people to feel like that he's the best person for the job and, you know, ignore the D and the R, you know, just vote for the person and the policy?
I mean, when I saw that announcement, I'm sitting there going, why? why would you do that? I mean, in the last 2 weeks of the election, you should be up and down the state. I mean, as I tell candidates, your two jobs are voter contact and raising money, right? And in the latter part, hopefully you've raised the money and you're just doing what you can to make sure you get out the vote. To add an appointment as the deputy, I just don't know what the goal was in that, other than maybe when McGinnis, if she wins, that she has to let him go, right? So there's a visual for that. But I just think it's a distraction, and one, to me, it seemed to be a concession of defeat for the race. The other difference between Simpler, one, he's loaned himself, you know, money as he's able to, but he's raised a significant amount of money. Yeah. He's well positioned to message and, you know, deliver a message as it relates to his campaign. Spadola has underperformed that's a tough race to raise money.
Sure, absolutely.
But he just hasn't done enough, I think, to get the traction he needs. So I think McGinnis name recognition, sort of winning in a primary, raising money, communicating.
And she also ran for lieutenant governor, so she had a little infrastructure ahead of time as well.
Absolutely, and then she's raised money to be able to sort of communicate effectively in that race. So I just saw it as a distraction, and And again, with the other factors involved, sort of top a ticket, not raising money, and not really seeing much of a campaign, that I think he's in trouble.
Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, since it's Delaware, we can be very personal. I think that James Spadola has shown himself to be a very strong, good candidate running as himself and running as a Castle type of Republican. He came in and ran against Harris McDowell, who is a Democratic stalwart, you know, untouchable. Nobody would even run against him. And Spadola fared very well, you know, compared to expectations. You know, the auditor candidate for the Republicans, you know, drops out. And, you know, who's going to pick up the mantle? Well, you have this young man who's clearly committed to public service, you know, from his post, his prior positions, you know, as a Newark police officer, and doing it in a way that's different, doing it in a way that reaches community and shows love and connection for the community. You know, he jumps in as auditor because he has a financial background and wants to give people a choice. You know, in a normal election cycle when everything's equal, I think that type of candidate can be very appealing, and I look forward to James running again. You know, just like the Kathleen Jennings did did running as lieutenant governor, then running again for a race. Right. If he's not able to prevail in this race, but as Daryl said, how much excitement can be raised over state auditor when nobody really exactly knows what that position is and is really supposed to do, and B, haven't we had the same guy do that? Like, can't we just keep that same guy doing that so we don't have to worry about it and vote for him again?
Then finally, the answer to that question is no. I do want to wrap up on the statewide stuff with the AG's race, which really seems to have just kind of like disappeared since the primary. You have the Democrat turned Republican Bernard Pepekai against the Democrat Kathy Jennings. Obviously, Jennings did well in the primary, and a lot of that was because she had name recognition, she had fundraise, she had a lot of advantages. Is it fair to say that those advantages hold here, and Pepekai has little or no chance to pull an upset off in this race?
Short answer for me is yes. I think Jennings has proven to be an effective campaigner. She's raised money again since the election, and recently announced former Vice President Joe Biden's endorsement. So there's a little bit of excitement about, and again, name recognition is sort of the opportunity to affiliate or, you know, sort of you know, be affiliated with. Yeah, Joe. You'll remember his name soon, buddy.
Yeah, you know, that's an incredibly uphill race, and one that, you know, Republicans are still scratching their head about, you know, regardless of the candidate themselves. You know, he kind of came to the rescue to be another candidate, mm-hmm. but from a very, very Democrat position. It's good to have, you know, I think it's good to have contested races and you know, that the voters have a choice come election day, which I think we have too little of down ballot in Delaware. So I'll never dissuade somebody from stepping in and running, even if they're, quote, not a Republican, true Republican or this or that. But, you know, in a very uphill battle anyway, running as a Republican, to have a Democrat switch over, difficult. But does Bernard Pepekai have any advantages that a Republican wouldn't in running this sort of race? You know, can he get the attention to enough people of the fact that he actually isn't a Republican, but he's running it in a Republican slot because he thinks he can do a better job for the job? You know, does he have support in areas, you know, where Republicans aren't even on the ballot,
mm-hmm.
and then that Bernard Pepekai, being a Democrat, can draw support from? Because statewide candidates, you know, we don't want to go back into the treasurer and auditor race, but where they're running in a district with no Republican candidates down ballot, that's very difficult. You know, does Bernard Pepekai actually have an advantage there, being a Democrat, being able to establish connections with voting blocks, especially in urban areas?
Thanks to Delaware Public Media political analysts Tom Kovac and Daryl Scott. We'll hear more from them next week when they examine some of the key General Assembly races and during our election night coverage Tuesday, November 6th. And we wrap up The Green next with another arts playlist, looking at an exhibition offered by the Historic Odessa Foundation. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. There's a new exhibit at the Historic Odessa Foundation. It's called Time Elemental, an exploration of the visual expression of Thomas Delport. It features more than 38 works by Delport, a Delaware artist living in Wilmington. Delport studied under Wilmington master painter Edward Loper, and his work reflects that influence. In this week's arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele speaks with Brian Miller, the Historic Odessa Foundation's assistant curator, about the artist and the exhibition.
Talk to me about Time Elemental, an exploration of the visual expression of Thomas Delport. What's it all about?
Oh, yes. At our visitor center at the Historic Odessa Foundation, we have paintings in three categories. Subject matters include the figure, landscape, and still life. So this artist is, sort of an expert on three categories, and he was a former student of the great Wilmington African-American artist Edward Loper Sr., and he studied with him towards the end of his life there, and he learned all about the Loper method and the Loper School of Art, painting color next to color and painting, just sort of an abstract look at things, and they just look wonderful in our gallery space in Odessa.
Now, I want to step aside for a second, but coming up in November, I believe it is, you will be giving a talk about Edward L. Loper Sr., but let's stick with the new exhibit, Time Elemental, which is presenting more than 38 weeks by Delaware artist Thomas Delport. Give me some more background about the artist.
Sure. As I mentioned, he studied with Edward Loper, and he came into painting later in life. He had a career, I'm not sure what he was in before, but anyways, I had seen his work at the Biggs Museum of American Art because he won a fellowship through the Delaware Division of the Arts, a state agency that supports the arts in Delaware, obviously, and was taken by his work, and I wasn't familiar with him, so I reached out to him, and then we got together and organized an exhibit. And, again, it just looks really amazing to see his work, just lush color, very thick paint. He has inspiration from, say, Van Gogh to Renoir and, Impressionism. We try to get a variety of types of work at our museum so to get different audiences involved in the state and, in our area to, just to see a variety of works.
So Thomas Delport's collection is going to be on display at the Historic Odessa Foundation through December 30th. What can people expect when they walk through the doors?
Right. When they come in, they'll see a sign of the exhibit, and each work obviously is labeled. And interesting, all of the works of art are for sale. The museum does not get involved in the sale of the works. We're mainly an exhibit. We're a nonprofit museum. But if you're interested in purchasing any of the works that you love at the museum, you just contact the artist, and then he can, make arrangements for that. But all of the works will stay, as you said, till the end of December, December 30th. That's kind of the end of our season. And then we open back up in March. So we're closed for 2 months, January and February. But anyways, when you come into the gallery, you just notice all of the color. And again, over 38 works. You know, it just really fills the space nicely. And against the warm color walls that we have, a lot of people remark that, or a lot of visitors remark that how, you know, the artwork just really stands out. And we have really good lighting as well.
That's always great. That's always important. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about Thomas Delporte and the fact that he's been a student of several Delaware masters. He has studied at the famed Barnes Foundation while it was still in Marion, Pennsylvania. His passion for learning about art is an ongoing endeavor. And I understand that he teaches his love for art and painting to private students and groups.
Yeah, I'm not real familiar with all of that. He has taught classes at the Delaware College of Art and Design, and I think maybe at his own studio he has private lessons, a very similar thing to what Mr. Loper did.
All right, that's great. Now, going back to Mr. Loper, on Thursday, November 15th, you will be giving a talk on Edward L. Loper Sr. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I had the great privilege of meeting Mr. Loper in the late 1990s, and I was doing a master's degree, and I had the great opportunity to interview Mr. Loper, visit his studio, visit him a few times, and then also interview seven of his students. So then 700 and some pages later for a master's thesis, it explains all about Mr. Loper as an artist and Mr. Loper as an art educator, which the degree was in art education. So I really wanted to bring that out. You know, how did he teach? Who did he teach? Where did he teach? What were his methods? So it's all very well documented. And at would have been Mr. Loper's 100th birthday 2 years ago in 2016. The University of Delaware had an exhibit of his work, and I got to give sort of the keynote presentation related to Loper and his teaching at the university galleries.
And how can people get tickets for that?
They just simply call the museum and make a reservation. It's free for members, and I think it's only $5 for non-members, but obviously it's open to the public.
And again, that'll be for people who want to attend. That'll be on Thursday, November 15th, starting at 6 p.m. Do this for me, Brian. Tell people what the Historic Odessa Foundation is all about for people who are not familiar.
Sure. The Historic Odessa Foundation is an enclave of great 18th century homes and buildings that you can tour Tuesday through Sunday. Normal museum hours are simply 10 o'clock till 4:30, and then Sundays 1 o'clock to 4:30. But anyways, great 18th century homes. One, a National Historic Landmark, the Corbett Sharp House, and then the others all listed on the National Historic Register, as well as the whole town listed on the National Historic Register. So furnished in great antiques and original furnishings that the original owners, you know, had purchased for their homes. And, you know, just a really great little village, little town in Delaware.
That's great. Is there a website that people can check out?
Oh, sure. The greatest place to find information related to Historic Odessa Foundation is the website, which is simply, you know, www.historicodessa.org.
All right, we're talking to Brian Miller. He is the assistant curator for the Historic Odessa Foundation. Brian, before I let you go, anything else that we left out about time elemental and exploration of the visual expression of Thomas Delporte?
I don't think we left anything out. It's a great exhibit, and we hope that the public comes out to see it. It's there till the end of December, so there's plenty of time to see the exhibit.
Thanks to Historic Odessa Foundation Assistant Curator Brian Miller and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. You can learn more about Time Elemental, an exploration of the visual expression of Thomas Delporte, at historicodessa.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head over to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, political analysts Tom Kovach and Daryl Scott, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.